Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2010.
Welcome, everybody, to Thrilling Tales, the story time for grown-ups. Thrilling Tales happens on the first and third Monday of every month. Oh, and my name is David Wright. I'm a librarian here. I work in the fiction department up on the third floor. The Open Window by H.H. Monroe, better known as Saki. My aunt will be down presently, Mr. Nuttall, said a very self-possessed young lady of 15. In the meantime, you must try to put up with me. Frampton Nuttall endeavored to say the correct something which should duly flatter the niece of the moment without unduly discounting the aunt that was to come. Privately, he doubted more than ever whether these formal visits on a succession of total strangers would do much towards helping the nerve cure which he was supposed to be undergoing. I know how it will be, his sister had said when he was preparing to migrate to this rural retreat. You will bury yourself down there and not speak to a living soul, and your nerves will be worse than ever for the moping. I shall just give you letters of introduction to all the people I know there. Some of them, as far as I can remember, were quite nice. Frampton wondered whether Mrs. Sappleton, the lady to whom he was presenting one of the letters of introduction, came into the nice division. Do you know many of the people round here? Asked the niece, when she judged that they had had sufficient silent communion. Hardly a soul, said Frampton. My sister was staying here at the rectory, you know, some 4 years ago, and she gave me letters of introduction to some of the people here. He made the last statement in a tone of distinct regret. Well, then you know practically nothing about my aunt, pursued the self-possessed young lady. Only her name and address, admitted the caller. He was wondering whether Mrs. Sappleton was in the married or widowed state. An undefinable something about the room seemed to suggest masculine habitation. Her great tragedy happened just 3 years ago, said the child. That would be since your sister's time. Her tragedy? Asked Frampton. Somehow in this restful country spot, tragedies seemed out of place. You may wonder why we keep that window wide open on an October afternoon, said the niece, indicating a large French window that opened onto a lawn. It is quite warm for this time of the year, said Frampton, but has that window got anything to do with the tragedy? Out through that window, 3 years ago to a day, her husband and her two young brothers went off for their day's shooting. They never came back. In crossing the moor to their favorite snipe shooting ground, they were all three engulfed in a treacherous piece of bog. It had been that dreadful wet summer, you know, and places that were safe in other years gave way suddenly without warning. Their bodies were never recovered. That was the dreadful part of it. Here, the child's voice lost its self-possessed note and became falteringly human. Poor aunt always thinks that they will come back someday, they and that little brown spaniel that was lost with them, and walk in at that window, just as they used to do. That is why the window is kept open every evening till it is quite dusk. Poor dear aunt. She's often told me how they went out, her husband with his white waterproof coat over his arm, and Ronnie, her youngest brother, singing, Bertie, why do you bound? As he always did, to tease her, because she said it got on her nerves. You know, sometimes on still, quiet evenings like this, I almost get a creepy feeling that they will all walk in through that window. She broke off with a little shudder. It was a relief to Frampton when the aunt bustled into the room with a whirl of apologies for being late in making her appearance. "Oh, I hope Vera has been amusing you," she said. "She has been very interesting," said Frampton. "I hope you don't mind the open window," said Mrs. Sappleton briskly. "My husband and brothers will be home directly from shooting, and they always come in this way. Oh, they've been out for snipe on the marshes today, so they'll make a fine mess on my poor carpets. So like you menfolk, isn't it?" She rattled on cheerfully about the shooting and the scarcity of birds and the prospects for duck in the winter. To Frampton, it was all purely horrible. He made a desperate but only partially successful effort to turn the talk onto a less ghastly topic. He was conscious that his hostess was giving him only a fragment of her attention, and her eyes were constantly straying past him to the open window and the lawn beyond. It was certainly an unfortunate coincidence that he should have paid his visit on this tragic anniversary. "The doctors agree in ordering me complete rest, an absence of mental excitement, and avoidance of anything in the nature of violent physical exercise," announced Frampton, who labored under the tolerably widespread delusion that total strangers and chance acquaintances are hungry for the least detail of one's ailments and infirmities, their cause and cure. "On the matter of diet, they were not so much in agreement," he continued. "No?" said Mrs. Sappleton in a voice which only replaced a yawn at the last moment. Then she suddenly brightened into alert attention, but not to what Frampton was saying. "Here they are at last," she cried, "just in time for tea. And don't they look as if they were muddy up to the eyes?" Frampton shivered slightly and turned towards the niece with a look intended to convey sympathetic comprehension. The child was staring out through the open window with dazed horror in her eyes. In a chill shock of nameless fear, Frampton swung round in his seat and looked in the same direction. In the deepening twilight, three figures were walking across the lawn towards the window. They all carried guns under their arms, and one of them was additionally burdened with a white coat hung over his shoulders. A tired brown spaniel kept close at their heels. Noiselessly, they neared the house, and then a hoarse young voice chanted out of the dusk, "I said, Bertie, why do you bound?" Frampton grabbed wildly at his stick and hat. The hall door, the gravel drive, and the front gate were dimly noted stages in his headlong retreat. A cyclist coming along the road had to run into the hedge to avoid an imminent collision. "Here we are, my dear," said the bearer of the white mackintosh, coming in through the window. "Fairly muddy, but most of it's dry. Who was that who bolted out as we came up?" "A most extraordinary man, Mr. Nuttall," said Mrs. Sappleton, "could only talk about his illnesses and dashed off without a word of goodbye or apology when you arrived. One would think he'd seen a ghost." "I expect it was the spaniel," said the niece calmly. "He told me he had a horror of dogs. He was once hunted into a cemetery somewhere on the banks of the Ganges by a pack of pariah dogs, and he had to spend the night in a newly dug grave with creatures snarling and grinning and foaming just above him. Well, it's enough to make anyone lose their nerve." Romance at short notice was her specialty. Our second story in this festival of short shorts is The Romance of a Busy Broker by O. Henry. Pitcher, confidential clerk in the office of Harvey Maxwell, broker, allowed a look of mild interest and surprise to visit his usually expressionless countenance when his employer briskly entered at 9:30 in company with his young lady stenographer. With a snappy, "Good morning, Pitcher," Maxwell dashed at his desk as though he were intending to leap over it, and then plunged into the great heap of letters and telegrams waiting there for him. The young lady had been Maxwell's stenographer for a year. She was beautiful in a way that was decidedly unstenographic. She forewent the pomp of the alluring pompadour. She wore no chains, bracelets, or lockets. She had not the air of being about to accept an invitation to luncheon. Her dress was gray and plain, but it fitted her figure with fidelity and discretion. In her neat black turban hat was the gold-green wing of a macaw. On this morning, she was softly and shyly radiant. Her eyes were dreamily bright, her cheeks genuine peach blow, her expression a happy one tinged with reminiscence. Pitcher, still mildly curious, noticed a difference in her ways this morning. Instead of going straight into the adjoining room where her desk was, she lingered slightly irresolute in the outer office. Once she moved over by Maxwell's desk near enough for him to be aware of her presence. The machine sitting at that desk was no longer a man. It was a busy New York broker moved by buzzing wheels and uncoiling springs. "Well, what is it? Anything?" asked Maxwell sharply. His opened mail lay like a bank of stage snow on his crowded desk. His keen gray eye, impersonal and brusque, flashed upon her half impatiently. "Nothing," answered the stenographer, moving away with a little smile. "Mr. Pitcher," she said to the confidential clerk, "did Mr. Maxwell say anything yesterday about engaging another stenographer?"
"He did," answered Pitcher. "He told me to get another one. I notified the agency yesterday afternoon to send over a few samples this morning. It's 9:45 o'clock, and not a single picture hat or piece of pineapple chewing gum has shown up yet."
"I will do the work as usual, then," said the young lady, "until someone comes to fill the place." And she went to her desk at once and hung the black turban hat with a gold-green macaw wing in its accustomed place. He who has been denied the spectacle of a busy Manhattan broker during a rush of business is handicapped for the profession of anthropology. The poet sings of the crowded hour of glorious life. The broker's hour is not only crowded, but the minutes and seconds are hanging to all the straps and packing both the front and rear platforms. And this day was Harvey Maxwell's busy day. The ticker began to reel out jerkily in fitful coils of tape. The desk telephone had a chronic attack of buzzing. Men began to throng into the office and call at him over the railing, jovially, sharply, viciously, excitedly. Messenger boys ran in and out with messages and telegrams. The clerks in the office jumped about like sailors during a storm. Even Pitcher's face relaxed into something resembling animation. On the exchange, there were hurricanes and landslides and snowstorms and glaciers and volcanoes, and those elemental disturbances were reproduced in miniature in brokers' offices. Maxwell shoved his chair against the wall and transacted business after the manner of a toe dancer. He jumped from ticker to phone, from desk to door, with the trained agility of a harlequin. In the midst of this growing and important stress, the broker became suddenly aware of a high-rolled fringe of golden hair under a nodding canopy of velvet and ostrich tips, an imitation sealskin sack, and a string of beads as large as hickory nuts, ending near the floor with a silver heart. There was a self-possessed young lady connected with these accessories, and Pitcher was there to construe her. "A lady from the stenographer's agency to see about the position," said Pitcher. Maxwell turned half around with his hands full of papers and ticker tape. "What position?" he asked, with a frown. "Position of stenographer," said Pitcher. "You told me yesterday to call him up and have one send one over this morning." "You are losing your mind, Pitcher," said Maxwell. "Why should I have given you any such instructions? Miss Leslie has given perfect satisfaction during the year she's been here. The place is hers, as long as she chooses to retain it. There's no place open here, ma'am. Countermand that order with the agency, Pitcher, and don't bring any more of them in here." The silver heart left the office, swinging and banging itself independently against office furniture as it indignantly departed. Pitcher seized a moment to remark to the bookkeeper that the old man seemed to get more absent-minded and forgetful every day of the world. The rush and pace of business grew fiercer and faster. On the floor, they were pounding half a dozen stocks in which Maxwell's customers were heavy investors. Orders to buy and sell were coming and going as swift as the flight of swallows. Some of his own holdings were imperiled, and the man was working like some high-geared, delicate, strong machine, strung to full tension, going at full speed, accurate, never hesitating, with a proper word and decision and act, ready and prompt as clockwork. Stocks and bonds, loans and mortgages, margins and securities. Here was a world of finance.
and there was no room in it for the human world or the world of nature. When the luncheon hour drew near, there came a slight lull in the uproar. Maxwell stood by his desk with his hands full of telegrams and memoranda, with a fountain pen over his right ear and his hair hanging in disorderly strings over his forehead. His window was open, for the beloved janitress Spring turned on a little warmth through the waking registers of the earth. And through the window came a wandering, perhaps a lost, odor, a delicate, sweet odor of lilac that fixed the broker for a moment, immovable. For this odor belonged to Miss Leslie. It was her own and hers only. The odor brought her vividly, almost tangibly before him. The world of finance dwindled suddenly to a speck, and she was in the next room, 20 steps away. "By George, I'll do it now," said Maxwell, half aloud. "I'll ask her now. I wonder I didn't do it long ago." He dashed into the inner office with the haste of a short trying to cover. He charged upon the desk of the stenographer. She looked up at him with a smile. A soft pink crept over her cheek, and her eyes were kind and frank. Maxwell leaned one elbow on her desk. He still clutched fluttering papers with both hands, and the pen was above his ear. "Miss Leslie," he began hurriedly, "I have but a moment to spare, and I want to say something in that moment. Will you be my wife? I haven't had time to make love to you in the ordinary way, but I really do love you. Now, talk quick, please. The fellows are clubbing the stuffing out of Union Pacific." What are you talking about?" exclaimed the young lady. She rose to her feet and gazed upon him, round-eyed. Don't you understand, said Maxwell, restively. I want you to marry me. I love you, Miss Leslie. I wanted to tell you. I snatched a minute when things had slackened up a bit. They're calling me from the phone now. Tell them to wait a minute, Pitcher. Won't you, Miss Leslie? The stenographer acted very queerly. At first, she seemed overcome with amazement. Then tears flowed from her wondering eyes. And then she smiled sunnily through them, and one of her arms slid tenderly about the broker's neck. "I know now," she said softly. "It's this old business that has driven everything else out of your head for the time. I was frightened at first. Don't you remember, Harvey? We were married last evening at 8 o'clock in the little church around the corner." The end. And another one. Story number three. This is called John Mortensen's Funeral, and it's by Ambrose Bierce. John Mortensen was dead. His lines in The Tragedy Man had all been spoken, and he had left the stage. The body rested in a fine mahogany coffin fitted with a plate of glass. All the arrangements for the funeral had been so well attended to that, had the deceased known, he doubtless would have approved. The face, as it showed under the glass, was not disagreeable to look upon. It bore a faint smile, and as the death had been painless, had not been distorted beyond the repairing power of the undertaker. At 2 o'clock of the afternoon, the friends were to assemble to pay their last tribute of respect to one who had no further need of friends or respect. The surviving members of the family came severally every few minutes to the casket and wept above the placid features beneath the glass. This did them no good. It did no good to John Mortensen. But in the presence of death, reason and philosophy are silent. As the hour of 2 approached, the friends began to arrive, and after offering such consolation to the stricken relatives as the proprieties of the occasion required, solemnly seated themselves about the room with an augmented consciousness of their importance in the scheme funereal. Then the minister came, and in that overshadowing presence the lesser lights went into eclipse. His entrance was followed by that of the widow, whose lamentations filled the room. She approached the casket, and after leaning her face against the cold glass for a moment, was gently led to a seat near her daughter. Mournfully and low, the man of God began his eulogy of the dead, and his doleful voice, mingled with the sobbing which it was its purpose to stimulate and sustain, rose and fell, seemed to come and go,
like the sound of a sullen sea. The gloomy day grew darker as he spoke. A curtain of cloud underspread the sky, and a few drops of rain fell audibly. It seemed as if all nature were weeping for John Mortensen. When the minister had finished his eulogy with prayer, a hymn was sung, and the pallbearers took their places beside the bier. As the last notes of the hymn died away, the widow ran to the coffin, cast herself upon it, and sobbed hysterically. Gradually, however, she yielded to dissuasion, becoming more composed, and as the minister was in the act of leading her away, her eyes sought the face of the dead beneath the glass. She threw up her arms and with a shriek fell backward insensible. The mourners sprang forward to the coffin, the friends followed, and as the clock on the mantel solemnly struck three, all were staring down upon the face of John Mortensen, deceased. They turned away, sick and faint. One man, trying in his terror to escape the awful sight, stumbled against the coffin so heavily as to knock away one of its frail supports. The coffin fell to the floor. The glass was shattered to bits by the concussion. From the opening crawled John Mortensen's cat, which lazily leapt to the floor, sat up, tranquilly wiped its crimson muzzle with a forepaw, and then walked with dignity from the room. Story number four. This one is called The Storyteller, and it's by Saki. It was a hot afternoon, and the railway carriage was correspondingly sultry. And the next stop was Templecombe, nearly an hour ahead. The occupants of the carriage were a small girl, and a smaller girl, and a small boy. An aunt belonging to the children occupied one corner seat, and the further corner seat in the opposite side was occupied by a bachelor who was a stranger to their party, but the small girls and the small boy emphatically occupied the compartment. Both the aunt and the children were conversational in a limited, persistent way, reminding one of the attentions of a housefly that refuses to be discouraged. Most of the aunt's remarks seemed to begin with "don't," and nearly all of the children's remarks began with "why." The bachelor said nothing out loud. "Don't, Cyril, don't," exclaimed the aunt, as the small boy began smacking the cushions of the seat, producing a cloud of dust at each blow. "Come and look out of the window," she added. The child moved reluctantly to the window. "Why are those sheep being driven out of that field?" he asked. "I expect they're being driven to another field where there's more grass," said the aunt weakly. "But there's lots of grass in that field," protested the boy. "There's nothing else but grass there. Aunt, there's lots of grass in that field." "Well, perhaps the grass in the other field is better," suggested the aunt fatuously. "Why is it better?" came the swift, inevitable question. "Oh, look at those cows," exclaimed the aunt. Nearly every field along the line had contained cows or bullocks, but she spoke as though she were drawing attention to a rarity. "Why is the grass in the other field better?" persisted Cyril. The frown on the bachelor's face was deepening to a scowl. He was a hard, unsympathetic man, the aunt decided in her mind. She was utterly unable to come to any satisfactory decision about the grass in the other field. The smaller girl created a diversion by beginning to recite "On the Road to Mandalay." She only knew the first line, but she put her limited knowledge to the fullest possible use. She repeated the line over and over again in a dreamy but resolute and very audible voice. It seemed to the bachelor as though someone had had a bet with her that she could not repeat the line aloud 2,000 times without stopping. Whoever it was had made the wager was likely to lose his bet. "Come over here and listen to a story," said the aunt, when the bachelor had looked twice at her and once at the communication cord. The children moved listlessly toward the aunt's end of the carriage. Evidently, her reputation as a storyteller did not rank high in their estimation.
in a low, confidential voice, interrupted at frequent intervals by loud, petulant questionings from her listeners, she began an unenterprising and deplorably uninteresting story about a little girl who was good and made friends with everyone on account of her goodness, and was finally saved from a mad bull by a number of rescuers who admired her moral character. "Wouldn't they have saved her if she hadn't been good?" demanded the bigger of the small girls. It was exactly the question that the bachelor had wanted to ask.
"Well, yes," admitted the aunt lamely, "but I don't think they would have run quite so fast if they hadn't liked her so much."
"It's the stupidest story I ever heard," said the bigger of the small girls with immense conviction. "I didn't listen after the first bit. It was so stupid," said Cyril. The smaller girl made no actual comment on the story, but she had long ago recommenced a murmuring repetition of her favorite line.
"You don't seem much of a success as a storyteller," said the bachelor suddenly from his corner.
The aunt bristled in instant defense at this unexpected attack.
"It's a very difficult thing to tell stories that children can both understand and appreciate," she said stiffly.
"I don't agree with you," said the bachelor.
"Perhaps you would like to tell them a story."
"Tell us a story," demanded the bigger of the small girls. "Once upon a time," began the bachelor, "there was a little girl called Bertha who was extraordinarily good." The children's momentarily aroused interest began at once to flicker. All stories seemed dreadfully alike, no matter who told them. "She did all that she was told, and she was always truthful. She kept her clothes clean, ate milk puddings as though they were jam tarts, learned her lessons perfectly, and was polite in her manners."
"Was she pretty?"
asked the bigger of the small girls. "Well, not as pretty as any of you," said the bachelor, "but she was horribly good." There was a wave of reaction in favor of the story. The word horrible in connection with goodness was a novelty that commended itself. It seemed to introduce a ring of truth that was absent from the aunt's tales of infant life. "She was so good," said the bachelor, "that she won several medals for goodness, which she always wore pinned onto her dress. There was a medal for obedience, another medal for punctuality, and a third for good behavior. They were large metal medals, and they clicked against one another as she walked. No other child in the town where she lived had as many as 3 medals, so everybody knew that she must be an extra good child."
"Horribly good," quoted Cyril.
"And everybody talked about her goodness, and the prince of the country got to hear about it. And he said that as she was so very good, she might be allowed once a week to walk in his park, which was just outside of the town. It was a beautiful park, and no children were ever allowed in it, so it was a great honor for Bertha to be allowed to go there."
"Were there any sheep in the park?" demanded Cyril.
"No," said the bachelor, "there were no sheep."
"Why weren't there any sheep?" came the inevitable question arising out of that answer.
The aunt permitted herself a smile which might almost have been described as a grin. "There were no sheep in the park," said the bachelor, "because the prince's mother had once had a dream that her son would either be killed by a sheep or else by a clock falling on him. And for that reason, the prince never kept sheep in his park or a clock in his palace." The aunt suppressed a gasp of admiration.
"Was the prince killed by a sheep or a clock?" asked Cyril.
"Well, he's still alive, so we can't tell whether the dream will come true," said the bachelor unconcernedly. "Anyway, there were no sheep in the park, but there were lots of little pigs running all over the place."
"What color were they?"
"Black with white faces, and white with black spots, black all over, gray with white patches, and some were white all over." The storyteller paused to let a full idea of the park's treasures sink into the children's imaginations. Then he resumed. "Bertha was rather sorry to find that there were no flowers in the park. She had promised her aunts, with tears in her eyes, that she would not pick any of the kind prince's flowers, and she'd meant to keep her promise, so of course it made her feel silly to find there were no flowers to pick."
"Why weren't there any flowers?"
"Because the pigs had eaten them all," said the bachelor promptly. "The gardeners had told the prince that you couldn't have pigs and flowers, so he decided to have pigs and no flowers." There was a murmur of approval at the excellence of the prince's decision. So many people would have decided the other way. There were lots of other delightful things in the park. There were ponds with gold and blue and green fish in them, and trees with beautiful parrots that said clever things at a moment's notice, and hummingbirds that hummed all the popular tunes of the day. And Bertha walked up and down and enjoyed herself immensely, and thought to herself, if I were not so extraordinarily good, I should not have been allowed to come into this beautiful park and enjoy all that there is to be seen in it. And her three medals clinked against one another as she walked and helped to remind her how very good she really was. Just then, an enormous wolf came in prowling into the park to see if it could catch a fat little pig for its supper. "What color was it?" asked the children amid an immediate quickening of interest. Mud-colored, all over, with a black tongue and pale gray eyes that gleamed with unspeakable ferocity. The first thing that it saw in the park was Bertha. Her pinafore was so spotlessly white and clean that it could be seen from a great distance. Bertha saw the wolf and saw that it was stealing towards her, and she began to wish that she'd never been allowed to come into the park. She ran as hard as she could, and the wolf came after her with huge leaps and bounds. She managed to reach a shrubbery of myrtle bushes, and she hid herself in one of the thickest of the bushes. The wolf came sniffing among the branches, its black tongue lolling out of its mouth, and its pale gray eyes glaring with rage. Bertha was terribly frightened, and thought to herself, if I had not been so extraordinarily good, I should have been safe in town at this moment. However, the scent of the myrtle was so strong that the wolf could not sniff out where Bertha was hiding, and the bushes were so thick that he might have hunted about in them for a long time without catching sight of her. So he thought he might as well go off and catch a little pig instead. Bertha was trembling very much at having the wolf prowling and sniffing so near her. And as she trembled, the medal for obedience clicked against the medals for good conduct and punctuality. The wolf was just moving away when he heard the sound of the medals clinking, and he stopped to listen. And they clinked again in a bush quite near him. He dashed into the bush, his pale gray eyes gleaming with ferocity and triumph, and dragged Bertha out and devoured her to the last morsel. All that was left of her were her shoes and bits of clothing and the three medals for goodness. Were any of the little pigs killed? No, they all escaped. The story began badly, said the smaller of the small girls, but it had a beautiful ending. It's the most beautiful story I ever heard, said the bigger of the small girls with immediate decision. It's the only beautiful story I ever heard, said Cyril. A dissentient opinion came from the aunt. A most improper story to tell to young children. You have undermined the effects of years of careful teaching. At any rate, said the bachelor, collecting his belongings, preparatory to leaving the carriage, I kept him quiet for 10 minutes, which is more than you were able to do. Unhappy woman, he observed to himself as he walked down the platform of Templecombe Station. For the next 6 months or so, those children will assail her in public with demands for an improper story. Thank you. It is 20 minutes to one. For those of you who can stay, I have an improper story. This is Revolt of the Gods by Ambrose Bierce. My father was a deodorizer of dead dogs. My mother kept the only shop for the sale of cat's food in my native city. They did not live happily. The difference in social rank was a chasm which could not be bridged by the vows of marriage. It was indeed an ill-assorted and most unlucky alliance. As might have been foreseen, it ended in disaster. One morning, after the customary squabbles at breakfast, my father rose from the table, quivering and pale with wrath, and proceeded to the parsonage and thrashed the clergyman who had performed the marriage ceremony.
Well, the act was generally condemned, and public feeling ran so high against the offender that people would permit dead dogs to lie on their property until the fragrance was deafening rather than employ him. And the municipal authorities suffered one bloated old mastiff to utter itself from a public square in so clamorous an exhalation that passing strangers supposed themselves to be in the vicinity of a sawmill. My father was indeed unpopular. During these dark days, the family's sole dependence was on my mother's emporium for cat's meat. The business was profitable in that city, which was the oldest in the world. The cat was an object of veneration. Its worship was the religion of the country. The multiplication and addition of cats was a perpetual instruction in arithmetic. Naturally, any inattention to the wants of a cat was punished with great severity in this world and the next. So my good mother numbered her patrons by the hundred. Still, with an unproductive husband and 17 children, she had some difficulty in making both ends meet. And at last, the necessity of increasing the discrepancy between the cost price and the selling price of her carnal wares drove her to an expedient which proved eminently disastrous. She conceived the unlucky notion of retaliating by refusing to sell cat's meat until the boycott was taken off her husband. Well, on the day when she put this resolution into practice, the shop was thronged with excited customers, and others extended in turbulent, restless masses up four streets, out of sight. Inside, there was nothing but cursing, crowding, shouting, and menace. Intimidation was freely resorted to, several of my younger brothers and sisters being threatened with cutting up for the cats. But my mother was as firm as a rock, and the day was a black one for Sardassa, the ancient and sacred city that was the scene of these events. The lockout was vigorously maintained, and 750,000 cats went to bed hungry. The next morning, the city was found to have been placarded during the night with a proclamation by the Federated Union of Old Maids. This ancient and powerful order averred through its supreme executive head that the boycotting of my father and the retaliatory lockout of my mother were seriously imperiling the interest of religion. The proclamation went on to state that if arbitration were not adopted by noon that day, that all the old maids of the Federation would strike. And strike they did. The next act of this unhappy drama was an insurrection of cats. These sacred animals, seeing themselves doomed to starvation, held a mass meeting and marched in procession through the streets, swearing and spitting like fiends. This revolt of the gods produced such consternation that many pious persons died of fright, and all business was suspended to bury them and to pass terrifying resolutions. Well, matters were now about as bad as it seemed possible for them to be. Meetings among representatives of the hostile interests were held, but no understanding was arrived at that would hold. Every agreement was broken as soon as it was made, and each element of the discord was frantically appealing to the people. A new horror was in store. It will be remembered that my father was a deodorizer of dead dogs, but was unable to practice his useful and humble profession because no one would employ him. The dead dogs, in consequence, reeked rascally. Then they struck. From every vacant lot and public dumping ground, from every hedge and ditch and gutter and cistern, every crystal rill and the clabbered waters of all the canals and estuaries, from all the places, in short, which from time immemorial had been preempted by dead dogs and consecrated to the uses of them and their heirs and successors forever, they trooped innumerous, a ghastly crew. Their procession was a mile in length. Midway of the town, it met with a procession of cats in full song. The cats instantly exalted their backs and magnified their tails. The dead dogs uncovered their teeth, as in life, and erected such of their bristles as still adhered to the skin. The carnage that ensued was too awful for relation. The light of the sun was obscured by flying fur, and the battle was waged in the darkness, blindly and regardless. The swearing of the cats was audible miles away, while the fragrance of the dead dogs desolated seven provinces. How the battle might have resulted, it is impossible to say, but when it was at its fiercest, the Federated Union of Old Maids came running down a side street and sprang into the thickness of the fray. A moment later, my mother herself bore down upon the warring hosts,
brandishing a cleaver and laid about her with great freedom and impartiality. My father joined the fight, the municipal authorities engaged, and the general public, converging on the battlefield from all points of the compass, consumed itself in the center as it pressed in from the circumference. Last of all, the dead held a meeting in the cemetery and, resolving on a general strike, began to destroy vaults, tombs, monuments, headstones, willows, angels, and young sheep in marble, everything they could lay their hands on. By nightfall, the living and the dead were alike exterminated. And where the ancient and sacred city of Sardassa had stood, nothing remained but an excavation filled with dead bodies and building materials, shreds of cat, and blue patches of decayed dog. The place is now a vast pool of stagnant water in the center of a desert. The stirring events of these few days constituted my industrial education, and so well have I improved my advantages that I am now chief of misrule to the Dukes of Disorder, an organization numbering some 13 million American working men.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.